Ecclesiastes is an ancient philosophy book. It is given to us by God to help humans sort through this basic question, what gives meaning to your life? In it, King Solomon, who lived about 900 years before Jesus, seeks to influence, apparently, the young men, the young princes in his court who would have had a very broad international background. They wouldn't have come from his own worldview. They would have had very various competing ideas for who's out there, what makes life worth living. He wants everyone to read this book and answer this really uncomfortable question that many of us like to actually put to the fringes of our mind. What gives meaning to your life? That's the question he's getting at. We're now finishing the third of four sections in the book. In the first section, which was introduction, it was a riveting introduction, Solomon basically makes the really hard and uncomfortable point that meaning in life cannot be found in making a difference. Your great-grandchildren won't even remember your name. Life's meaning can't be found in pursuing pleasure. Pursuing pleasure is like chasing the wind. It's fleeting. Life's meaning can't be found in accumulating wisdom. People who are wise are going to die just like fools. And it can't be found in working hard. Again, accomplishments, whatever they are, will quickly be forgotten, at least their attachment with you, and it'll get passed on to the next generation, and who knows what they'll do with your entire life effort. That's his riveting, largely negative and pointed introduction. Don't look for these things to provide meaning in life. Chapters 3 through 7 are really the main point of Ecclesiastes, and they're bookended with two poems on how God is in control. We don't find meaning for our lives in what we do. We find meaning for our lives in trusting God's work. The main point of Ecclesiastes is that meaning in life comes from submitting to God's control, to his sovereign plan. We're told in these chapters that his plan is beautiful. It is absolutely certain, but it is mysterious. There's no chance of us actually figuring out what God himself is doing. And that's why meaning in life does not come from fighting injustice, accumulating wealth, or attaining power, where many people think meaning in life is going to come from. No, it comes from looking to God, being part of God's plan. Whether he gives you significant influence, great power, much wealth, or not, meaning in life is found in connecting your life faithfully to God. Now we're in the section I would call application. We recently studied chapters 8 and 9. Today we're studying chapter 10. These are all chapters on application. It's where Solomon takes his main point about trusting the God who's in control and asking, okay, so what does this have to do with your life? And what does this have to do with your life, particularly in your workplace? He said in chapters 8 and 9 that basically life's about this. It's living for God and doing what God says in your workplace, being a wise, responsible, faithful, obedient, respectful individual in your workplace, always remembering that your wisdom cannot control outcomes. Again, it's quite negative. He's saying no amount of wisdom on your part can ensure that you're going to have a great life, a problem-free life. Instead, you be wise, even though God's in control. Being wise doesn't put you in the control seat. No amount of wisdom can make you predict or control the outcomes in your life. You can't control God's plan. So he says you work wisely, but work remembering that God is sovereign. Today, in chapter 10, we look at Solomon's most pointed application, and wow, look out. It is remarkably relevant. In chapter 10, Solomon focuses on frustrations in the realm of politics. It's actually what we would expect because he's writing as a king to young men in his realm. Their workplace, the workplace of his original audience, would have been primarily political. We're going to see that all of the advice he gives certainly applies to people outside the realm of politics, but his focus is especially on the realm of politics. One Old Testament professor, Dwayne Garrett, puts it like this: much of chapter 9 and almost all of chapter 10 center on one common theme, the impulsive nature of political power. And Solomon is saying, here's what wisdom looks like in the infuriating world of politics. Let's read chapter 10. Again, I'm going to do so with some detailed comment. He starts Ecclesiastes 10, verse 1. Dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. It rots it. Even so, a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. The tiniest bit of sin can ruin an entire lifetime of reputation. That is true of politicians. It's true of everyone else. A wise man, verse 2, has a heart that inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. We must not think that this refers to the American political spectrum. Solomon is saying that your choices flow out of your heart. And foolish leaders are eventually going to be known for their true colors. Verse 3, even when a fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone around him, he's a fool. If the anger of a ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will allay great offenses. It will subdue great offenses. Mark that word, calmness. It's a central idea in this chapter. When a ruler or a politician you work for is a fool, Solomon says, be patient. Keep a calm, cool spirit. Verse 5. He says, there's an evil I've seen under the sun, as it were an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in a low place, or people of proven worth, I think might be a better translation than rich. Those of proven worth sit in a low place. I've seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. What Solomon is saying, there's a pervasive problem in the world of politics, and that is that many of the highest-ranking politicians are fools. And the people of proven worth often have the low-ranking jobs. It's exactly opposite what it should be. Now he's going to reflect on the huge risks in public office. Verse 8, you know he who digs a pit is going to fall into it, and a serpent might bite him who breaks through a wall. The people who are excavators tend to disturb the nests of wild animals. He who quarries stones is often hurt by them, and he who splits logs is endangered by them. If the iron is blunt, not sharp, one doesn't sharpen the edge, he must use more strength, but wisdom helps one to succeed. These are all illustrations regarding this realm of politics. Again, verse 11 says, if the serpent bites before its charm, there's no advantage to the charmer. What he's basically saying is, see, in this realm of politics, leaders work a very risky and difficult job. You have every reason in this realm of politics to be very careful. Influence brings with it great risk. And he's going to zero in now on politicians need to be really careful in their speech. Verse 12, the words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. That's a good translation of the Hebrew. It doesn't necessarily give the sense the way we would say it in our language. Verse 13 would be something like this in modern English. A foolish man's words are idiotic from beginning to end. His speeches start with lunacy, and in the end, none of his reasoning makes sense. The guy doesn't know what he's saying. Verse 14, a fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him? You know, politicians always promise a better future. They say, follow me, I'll make things better. But Solomon says, there is no way that they can control the future. They have no clue what the future holds. Verse 15, the toil of a fool wearies him, for he doesn't even know the way to the city. It's basically saying a fool or a foolish politician accomplishes little to nothing. But we shouldn't expect it from a guy who can't even give simple directions. If a guy can't give simple directions, he can't lead a successful country. Verse 16, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of the nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness." In those two very pointed reflections, Solomon basically says, a nation is doomed when its leaders are inexperienced and self-indulgent. A nation is richly blessed when its leaders are proven. They demonstrate over years of experience that they are self-controlled. And then he says, managing a nation is a bit like managing a house. Verse 18, through sloth, the roof sinks in. Through indolence, the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. He's saying, you better value a leader who's careful, who's diligent, who's not haphazard with how he uses money. But when your leaders are fools, he ends on this note, be careful. Verse 20, even in your thought, don't curse the king. Even if he is a curse to your nation, don't curse the king even in your thoughts or in your bedroom. Curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature will tell the matter. It's a very vivid way of saying critical remarks that you make have a way of getting around. Are you again impressed with how real to life the Bible is? It's remarkable that this is written 3,000 years ago. It's remarkable that it's written by King Solomon. He was an autocrat. And he is writing wisdom that is so honest about the real world of politics. For what it's worth, this is one of those chapters that leads me to think that Solomon is actually repentant and regretful of his own foolishness throughout his reign. I think you get a sense in here that he is like humbly reflecting on how difficult it must have been for guys to work under him. Solomon himself was often an oppressive ruler. The young men to whom Solomon was writing this had lives that were wrapped up in politics, which was a very frustrating world. And notice, Solomon is not urging them to get out. We need godly women and men to serve in the world of politics in full view of its constant frustrations. We need to thank God for godly men and women who are serving God and serving others in this difficult world. Solomon is not saying get out. He's not writing off the world of politics. He's saying this is how you live wisely in a world that is infuriating. And you know, it's not just people who live in the world and work in the world of politics who are frustrated by it. Many people who watch politics are similarly frustrated. You know the two most popular radio programs in the U.S.? A left-wing show and a right-wing show. And you know who listens to them mostly? Studies show that it's individuals age 55 and older. I simply observe that political frustrations are a deep concern, and that concern tends to grow with age. Here, in Ecclesiastes 10, Solomon's main point is, in the dangerous, infuriating world of politics, those who are wise live carefully and calmly, remembering that only God controls the future. In this infuriating world, people who are wise, who live for God and who trust God, don't get infuriated. They live carefully, calmly, remembering who holds the future. I want to unpack this main point in five parts. The first part is just verse 1. People's reputations are so vulnerable, especially politicians. People's reputations are so vulnerable. That's why wise people live cautiously. He says, very picturesquely, a little bad can ruin a lot of good. And it must be understood first on a political level, right? That's who he's writing to. One or two bad decisions in life can wreck an entire career in politics. Or, to state it more broadly, if a politician chooses one or two bad advisors, one or two bad advisors can wreak havoc in an entire administration. It's true of politicians. That's why those in politics, the people Solomon's writing to originally, must live cautiously. A little bad can ruin a lot of good. But it's not only true in politics. It's true for pastors. It's true for parents, right? It's true for people. Any follower of Jesus, I'm switching to the New Testament, should live thinking this. If you think you're strong, watch out. You're about to fall. That's 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12. Or Jesus said, this is how you should pray every day. Father, lead me not into temptation. Deliver me from the evil one. Does that kind of caution characterize your life? Maybe morning by morning, praying that prayer like Jesus taught. God, lead me not into temptation. Deliver me from evil. My entire life's reputation, I could ruin it in a stupid choice today. This is what Solomon's recommending for politicians. It applies to all of us. The second point is that many politicians are foolish and infuriating, yet wise people expect it and stay calm. I'm going to take a little more time with this one. Solomon observes here that politicians are often fools, and they make foolish decisions. But wise people who work for them or who watch them are marked by calmness. Solomon's concern here is our attitude, one of staying calm in full view of the idiocy and the injustices of those above us. We should maintain a patient and cool attitude. That's something that God can use to bring about change, actually. Let me point out the three parts of verse 4. Look at verse 4. First, he acknowledges that foolishness might abound in your superior. He might blow his fuse. Secondly, there's a recommendation. Keep your attitude in check. He basically says, don't quit, be calm. And thirdly, he says, that approach might lead to great influence. He says, calmness will pacify great offenses. To state the opposite, we demonstrate foolishness when our attitude toward our politicians is marked by regular infuriation. Believers, in this infuriating world of politics, you're wise to keep calm. Keep a cool spirit. Tri-County, we need this. Many politicians in our country are fools who make infuriating decisions. Many leading politicians in our country are marked by immorality, avarice, bribery, and they support the most inhumane causes. Politicians are fools who do infuriating things. Many of them are. And so much reaction to politics among Christians is not calm. We're not marked by calmness. Solomon says a wise person reacting to a foolish politician should be generally characterized by calmness. That calmness doesn't mean that we agree. It doesn't mean that we don't work for change. It doesn't mean that we don't have occasional outbursts of righteous anger. But in general, we're calm. I just urge you to think about the wise example of Daniel and his friends. They served an infuriating ruler, right? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. His infuriating decisions didn't lead them to infuriation. They respectfully disagreed. They humbly kept on obeying God. They prayed for God's strength. And in the end, do you know that they had huge influence on their superior? The whole point of the book of Daniel is that people like Nebuchadnezzar, people like Darius, keep coming to the conclusion that Daniel's God, or the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, needs to be feared. Why? It's not because they went on a rampage and said, "You're so wrong, I can't work here anymore." It's because they were calm, they were respectful, they kept on working under that rule as much as they could, disagreeing and engaging in civil disobedience when they had to, but they were calm. Their influence came through disagreement that was calm and controlled. They weren't temperamental. They weren't infuriated. I quote James chapter 1, verse 20. "Your anger will not bring about the righteousness that God desires." Of all people, Christians who are fully aware of this infuriating world of politics should be filled with calmness. We have a peace which passes understanding. It grows out of our confidence that Jesus is Lord. He's risen from the dead and he's Lord. And he's near. He's coming soon. Be calm. You know who's in control. You know how it's going to end. When politicians are infuriating, don't be infuriated. I recently spoke with a Christian man. He works in a large political organization. And I probed when I was talking with him, and I asked him to actually email me his response. It was profound. He said, "I hesitate sharing what I'm going to share with you because it could come off like I'm patting myself on the back. But I share it with you because I think it reinforces the Bible. I obviously work in a politically driven organization, and I've gone from being the lowest paid and least influential person in our organization to leading a staff that oversees thousands. In the last year," he said, "I had a 360-degree evaluation done where all the staff I work with, those above me, those below me, and those beside me, gave me feedback. He said, "My supervisor said the word that kept coming up describing me was unflappable. This trait only comes because my ultimate hope and peace is not in what I do and in the change I'm fighting for, but is in my eternal hope that justice will be had and tears will be wiped away. Although I ebb and flow with the frustrations of the times, my compass remains set only by the grace of God. Not many people I work with have my same hopes, but they need believers in their lives and in their spheres of relationships." He says, in essence, that people around him say, "You're marked by calmness. You're unflappable." Where does it come from? He says it comes from anchoring himself to the Lord, not from anchoring himself to the circumstances. Number 3, verses 8 through 11. Politics is a dangerous place to work, and those who are wise are extremely careful. In these couple of verses, Solomon warns that, especially in politics, every step has unexpected fallout. He basically teaches with these vivid illustrations that those who make the biggest difference are often at the greatest risk. In our day, let me just put verses 8 through 10 in my own words. He might say something like, "Those who operate backhoes and bulldozers and chainsaws are going to need lots of insurance. They make the biggest difference. They run the biggest risks." What he's saying is, in politics, there are so many risks, so many pitfalls, and all of us who are either working in the world of politics or watching what's going on in this world of politics should be really slow to criticize leaders in whose shoes we've never stood. We should be full of compassion with leaders who fail. We should regularly pray for politicians who face dangers and risks that most of us can't relate with. Recognizing that politics is such a dangerous place to work should fill us with carefulness and prayerfulness. Fourth, politicians, according to verses 12 to 15, tend to be big promise makers, but those who are wise speak with humility and with constraint. The mark of a wise politician is careful speech. Verse 12 says, bad leaders are marked by angry speech, not winsome speech. Verse 13, bad leaders are marked by asinine conclusions based on illogical arguments. Verse 14, bad leaders are marked by arrogant claims to know and control what's going to happen in the future. The point of the whole book of Ecclesiastes is recorded there in sum in verse 14, where he says, no one can predict or control the future. Chapters 3 through 7 emphasize that only God controls the future. Only God knows the future. Bottom line, according to verse 15, foolish leaders are all talk. They accomplish very little. And this wisdom should lead us to value leaders and value politicians who speak graciously, intelligently, and humbly. Number 5. Politicians doom or bless a land, and those who are wise demonstrate proven self-control. This is verses 16 to 20, the final verses of the chapter. Solomon says, if your leaders are self-indulgent, they're a curse to your nation. But if your leaders are marked by self-control and they're fiscally self-controlled, a nation is blessed through them. His concluding thought is that we should rejoice in diligent leaders, but be careful about criticizing bad leaders. In many places, criticizing a politician can cost you your life. Thankfully, America is not one of those places. Wisdom in this infuriating world of politics is marked by self-control. In both politicians and those who work for them or watch them, self-control is wise. I'm going to wrap up in just a second, but just before I do, let me point out, again, all of Solomon's advice for people in this world of politics really applies to everyone, right? It's not like only politicians should be self-controlled. It's not like only politicians should be careful in their speech. All of his wisdom regarding self-control and financial responsibility, they apply to politicians and they apply to everyone. Politicians should not be marked by drunkenness or laziness. No one should be marked by drunkenness or laziness, right? These are main ideas found throughout the Bible. Every Christian should be marked by honest, hard work and gracious speech, not just our leaders. There isn't really a double standard here. It's not like there's a higher standard for leaders. It's just that leaders have a higher degree of influence and will face a higher degree of accountability because of that influence. So here in chapter 10, Solomon is doing again what he's done throughout this whole book. He's teaching us not only what wisdom is, but how to use it in a horribly broken world. He's been doing it from the beginning. There's something wrong with this world. How do you live rightly in it? He's saying, in effect, here's what wisdom in a leader looks like, and here's how you respond in a world of foolish leaders. Again, I said it at the outset, and I stress it again. Solomon is saying, never ever think that your wisdom will lead you to a perfect, comfortable life. You must not use wisdom to try to ensure a perfect life. Wisdom involves making a choice to live carefully and faithfully before God, fully expecting that your life is going to be hard because God does whatever he wants and God has his reasons, though we don't understand them. Don't think that wisdom is going to lead to the perfect life. Be wise, live for God faithfully, fully expecting that there are going to be hardships that make no sense. That's his wisdom. He's been doing that all throughout the book. He's doing it here again. And I say again, isn't it just remarkable that this was written 3,000 years ago, and yet every point I just made cuts to the heart of politics in every country, whether the country is led by a dictator or whether it's a more stable representative democracy. What I just said applies to us whether we are Republicans or Democrats. This council doesn't cut just one way. It cuts every way. The scriptures are like a sword. And this 3,000-year-old advice cuts us all where we need it. It's wisdom. Followers of Jesus, those who are wise, are marked by calmness in life and speech. They're marked by calmness toward infuriating politicians. They're marked by carefulness. If you're not a Christian, you have not committed your life to Jesus, I'm now speaking to you. The application of this message for you is much, much simpler than living with calmness, trusting God's control. You don't need that yet. You need something much, much more basic. You don't need to worry about how you're reacting to politics this weekend. You need to concern yourself with the biggest political issue in the world. The biggest political issue in the world is that when God raised Jesus from the dead, he proved that Jesus is king on this planet. He proved that he raised Jesus to be his chosen king forever on this world. He proved by the resurrection that Jesus has power over death. He has universal power. He's going to reign forever as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jesus is going to reign. That's the political truth you've got to come to terms with. Forget about what's going on in Washington. Forget about the news outlets. What do you do with Jesus? I urge you to consider the Bible's testimony about Jesus. Jesus came, God's Son become man, the eternal Son of God in human flesh is Jesus of Nazareth. And he lived and he acted and he spoke in such a way that proved to people that he was the king of this planet. He spoke with authority. He acted with authority. He could command demons what to do. He could tell weather storms to stop. Jesus has authority, and he proved it repeatedly so that the guys who followed him knew he was God's chosen king. Peter at one point said, "You are God's chosen king for this planet." After years of personal experience with him, they knew he was God's chosen king for this planet. You've got to read the accounts of who Jesus is, what he did, and how he came to convince men to give up their lives for him, because they saw him not only still storms, but they saw him crucified and then alive after he was dead. You've got to come to terms with Earth's ruler, with Jesus, who is returning to reign. I urge you to commit your life to Earth's true king. Don't worry about politics today until you've answered the biggest political question in the world. Is the Bible's statement that Jesus is going to reign as King of Kings true? Deal with that issue before you deal with politics today. My final thought is for followers of Jesus. King Jesus didn't save us, Christians. He didn't save us, rescue us from our sins, and forgive us from all of our sins, and come in to change our lives. He didn't do this so that we would live lives griping about politics. He rescued us so that whatever the current political situation, we would always live with thankfulness that he was crucified for us. We would always live in the joy that he is alive. He is reigning and will reign, and we need to live in the hope that he's coming again. Jesus saved us so that we would completely reorient our lives. We don't have the same concerns, the same fundamental concerns, and the same anchors that non-Christians around us have. Jesus was crucified. He's risen. He's reigning. He's coming again. That's our anchor, Christians. Sadly, so many evangelicals talk today about politics in a way that is fearful, that's angry. Many times it's uninformed. Oftentimes it is disrespectful. It is infuriated foolishness. It's just like the politics we're often criticizing. According to God, infuriating politicians don't infuriate wise people. We show that we are wise when the decisions of politicians don't make or ruin our day. In this fallen world, we expect that politicians are often foolish. We endure it, and we have confidence that God is in control, that his plan is sovereign and beautiful, albeit mysterious. We're not going to understand it. And God is eventually coming to reign. This anchors us. God's control of this world anchors us in this infuriating realm of politics.